And the recording is set.
All right, I just put that in the chat. Hello, friends. Welcome to the 68th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the sub. Oops, wait, I'm way off on my. I didn't reset myself here. Okay. Yeah, here we go. This series is available on makara.us under the subheadings Moria Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. Previous episodes of this, the Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com up in the upper left-hand corner. Just click on the link and you can go right into the session. Okay, we are currently in the chapter entitled The Bimbine Table of Isis, which is actually better known as the Mensa Isiaka. It's a was discovered in early part of the first century and is thought to be of Roman origin. So we began our last section by taking a look at the original Egyptian gods and goddesses on which the deities and the Mensa Isiaka are based. So we'll start with a quick review of the nomenclature of the table itself. Quote, the table is divided into three equal compartments. Above are the 12 houses of heaven, and below are the corresponding work periods, while in the middle panel are 21 figures which correspond to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. In the center of this central panel is a seated figure, which MPH calls the pantomorphic INX. This Isis-like figure is an emblem of universal being. It's not just Isis, it's like an uber Isian figure, which corresponds to the Hebrew Yod, the letter, according to some, from which all the other letters were formed. Thus, it's keeping with this figure as the source of all the other figures. Note how the Yod conforms to the shape of the throne. Coincidence? Maybe, maybe not. The INX, which is what this figure is called, is encircled by an ophite or serpent-like triad, answering to the three mother letters of the Hebrew alphabet. You could say, if you're going to extend it into theosophical thought, that it represents the three aspects, first, second, and third aspect, or solar logoi. Or you could look at them as the three Kumara who inform Sanat Kumara. In the text, we next have, on the left are the Ibamorphic and Serapian triads. On the right are those of Nephthys and Hecate, representing active and passive, fixed and volatile, fructifying fire and generating water. So each pair of triads represent energetic opposites, with Thoth, who's here, you can tell him by his ibis-like head, and the solar Serapis representing the active, fiery, volatile aspect. And Nephthys, who's, whoops, where'd I go? Yeah, and then Nephthys here, and Hecate here, representing the quote unquote passive, fixed water generating aspect. These two triads are the positive and negative poles that are each philosophically completed by the central figure. In addition, each pair becomes a completed septenary through association with their source, the universal INX, who is the central figure. So it's, you know, it's for this reason and many others that I came to realize that this Mintsa Issiaka does have a profound esoteric internal logic, even though its connection to the actual qualities of the original Egyptian beings that these figures are drawn from is tenuous. It's dubious at best, but it is a it is its own esoteric system of thought. Interestingly, the central figure is also septenary, as shown here. And together, these three septenaries are directly related to the three primary realms in ancient Egypt. First, the sky or heaven realm, ruled by the sky goddess Nut, which was also the domain of the sun god Ra. Second, the earth realm, personified by the god Geb, shown here holding up the sky. And finally, the third realm, the Duat or underworld, the realm of the dead and the afterlife, where the souls of the deceased journeyed after death. In the next part of the text, MPH tells us that Eliphaz Levi related these three sets of seven to the 21 major trumps of the Tarot. Philosophically interesting idea, but you know, we have to ask, was the philosophy of the Tarot consciously embedded in the Mintsa Issiaka? Maybe, maybe not. There's some compelling evidence, which we looked at last time, suggesting a close association between the Tarot and the Mintsa Issiaka. But then again, the Tarot wasn't to surface and be recognized as the Tarot for another 1400 years. Next, we learned about W. Wynne Westcott's book entitled
Francis.
Yeah.
Sorry, hold on. Can you go back one slide?
Sure, sure.
Okay. Now, when you had this up earlier without the tarot, Ben had typed in on the left is Hapi, the intersex god of the inundatio.
I wonder if he's talking about this figure here.
Ben, help us out here.
Yeah, Hapi, intersex god. It's a man with pendulous breasts, sometimes pregnant, who represents the inundation of the Nile, abundance, and male and female being the opposites.
Okay, so it has its own opposition. And you see that in this figure, interestingly, that they together form their own opposition. You often see this, you see it over here too, that there's an opposition form, a kind of yin yang within this watery Nephthys. This actual triad is called the Hecate triad, or the three aspects of Hecate. That's the way it's described in the text. Which are called passive and water generating. But as we see, there are opposite aspects within these two triads, especially. Yeah, I can't directly speak to the role Hapi plays and how that would relate to this, because I'm not familiar enough with, but you just mentioned that they are male beings, but with quote unquote pendulous breasts, therefore suggesting an androgyny in and of themselves. That's interesting. Anybody else? You know,
well, Ben says inundation also related to Sirius rising season.
Right. Yeah, everything was built around the inundation of the Nile, at least exoterically. The Nile really determined the nature and qualities of all the gods. But esoterically, the Nile represents the flow of spirit. And that is the real source. It's one of those, the outer Nile is really a blind or an outer expression. You could look at it both ways. For this inner source of spirit. Okay. Yeah, so we went through, we're looking at Wynne's Westcott's book. This is really the best book on the Isiac tablet. It's relatively short, it's about 80 pages. It's actually an interesting read just to read straight through it and in relation to the to a image, of the table of the Mensa Isiaca. And I've put a link to this book online in the chat. So if you're interested, you can explore this further. Okay. So this book has detailed passages on each figure in the Mensa Isiaca. These descriptions leave little doubt that the figures within the table have a profound philosophical interconnectedness, which we discovered in this description of the central figure. So, because it really lies at the very heart of the table of the Mensa Isiaca, let's take the time to reread this passage and the following, that the one that this is the physical description, the next one interprets that physical description. So, could we get a reader for this, please?
In the center is placed the most important design, consisting of the great gate of the gods, an architectural canopy over a throne on which is a seated figure. On the top of the canopy are shown diverging flames. Below is a globe, double-winged, then a second winged globe. A third is also seen below the seat of the figure. Around the sides of the canopy are a series of squares in which are circles with eight divisions. Column marked with alternate black and white bands and surmounted by a head of Isis stands on each side of this canopy. Seated within is the figure of a female, dressed from waist downward with feather markings and having many closely placed breasts not shown in the drawing. On her head a fillet and a Numidian bird, a turkey surmounting this, on its back a basket from which arise two Persian leaves and two horns. These later found a disc on which is a scarabus. In her right hand is a lotus-flowered scepter, and her left hand is raised in attitude of command. Her seat is plain. The sitting dog is engraved on it. Below her seat is another design, an abacus, within which lies a monster nefer, part lion, part hog, a canopus between its forepaws. Behind it is seen a globe winged and combined with a serpent. Over its head is a crescent moon and the sun within it. On each side of the canopy are placed columns, and on each is a serpent, as if as a guard. You need a second reader?
Sorry, I was muted. So even more arresting than this description of the physical aspects of this central figure is the interpretation that immediately follows. So as we read the following, keep in mind that the word mens, M-E-N-S, means mind or intelligence. So could we get a reader, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
This central canopy represents the diffusion of the triform supreme mens, in the universal ways of the three worlds. From which process of evolution, the sensible world or universe emerges, called by Plutarch the Bourne of Horus, and by the Egyptians, the Great Gate of the Gods. The diverging flames on the summit of the canopy mean the eternal and incorruptible supreme men's, full of fire, light, and life. The influence is communicated to the intellectual, sensible, and elementary worlds, as pictured by the three-winged globes. The seated figure is the supreme mind, or pantomorphous inyex, multiform sphinx, or logos, word, or soul of the world, and is placed here in the middle, as in the center of universal nature. The sitting posture denotes power and dominion. The dog is drawn on the seat because the Isaic Inix is associated with the dog star Cirrus or Sothis. The feather winged clothing of the limbs denotes the sublime velocity of the higher powers. The abundance of breast denotes the unlimited powers of creation and preservation. The necklets denote the celestial orbs in constant movement. The fillet on the head or covering denotes the hidden procedure of nature. And the turkey, a Numidian-born bird of Marshall, of many colors and spots, denotes the variety of created things. The basket denotes abundance, and the Percy denotes that wisdom which administers all events. The horns denote the moon, and the scarabus and disc the sun. The scepter denotes that all things are modeled after the paternal men's. And the lotus means the unwearied procession alike by night and day. The raised left hand denotes the ruling power whose every command is fulfilled. This mother of universal nature, the Egyptian called Isis, and of her they indicated the inscription, "I am Isis, I am all that is, that has been, and that will be, and no mortal has ever yet withdrawn my veil."
Thank you, Scott. Yeah, I think it's any questions about this deeply insightful text? Okay, we're going to backtrack just a bit. You know, it's been a couple of months because of the conference series since we got together. So we'll backtrack just a bit to include a description of the diagram in the center of the page, because we kind of stopped just as we got started sort of unveiling the nature of this diagram. So his preamble for this is, after explaining his reticence to reveal that which Levi evidently felt was better left concealed, Westcott sums up his interpretation of the tablet as follows. So, interestingly, you know, usually the descriptions of the illustrations is directly beneath the illustration. Here it's part of the text itself. I think it's because it's quite a bit more extensive than would fit in the little box beneath it. So he opted to do it a little differently here. So can we get a reader, please?
Marianne, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The diagram of Levi, by which he explains the mystery of the tablet, shows the upper region divided into the four seasons of the year. each with three signs of the zodiac. And he has added the four-lettered sacred name, the Tetragrammaton, assigning Jod to Aquarius, that is Canopus, he to Taurus, that is Apis, Vau to Leo, that is Mamphta, and he final to Typhon. Note the cherubic parallel, man, bull, lion, and eagle. The fourth form is found either as scorpion or eagle, depending on the occult good or evil intention. In the demotic zodiac, the snake replaces the scorpion. The lower region he ascribes to the 12 simple Hebrew letters, associating them with the four quarters of the horizon. Compare the Sefer Yetzirah, caption 5, section 1, this, or capital 5, section 1.
Don't worry about that.
I'm sorry. The central region he ascribes to the solar powers and the planetary. In the middle, we see above the sun, marked Ops, and below it is a Solomon seal, above a cross. A double triangle hexapla, one light and one dark, triangle superposed, the whole forming a sort of complex symbol of Venus. To the Amorphous, he gives the three dark planets, Venus, Mercury, and Mars, placed around a dark triangle erect, denoting fire. To the Nepthean triad, he gives three light planets, Saturn, Luna, and Jupiter, around a light inverted triangle which denotes water. There is a necessary connection between water, female power, passive principle, Bina, and Sephirotic mother and bride. See the Kabbalah by Mathers.
Thank you, Arya. Okay, first, the diagram of Levi by which he explains the mystery of the tablet shows the upper region divided into the four seasons of the year, each with three signs of the zodiac, and he has added the four-lettered sacred name, the Tetragrammaton, assigning Yod to Aquarius, that is Canopus, that's the old Egyptian, supposedly, He to Taurus, that is Apis or Apis, Vau to Leo, that is Mamphta, that's again the speculative name of Leo in ancient Egypt, and He final to Typhon. So here's the referenced explanatory diagram as it appears in Levi's History of Magic, which is reproduced in the center of the page. The top four figures in this diagram are symbolic descriptions of the upper register of the Mensa Ithiaca. In order to directly relate the symbolism to the figures, I've here placed Levi's explanatory diagram directly above the top register of the table. Through Levi's illustration, we are given the identity of gods and goddesses in the upper register, beginning with the winter solstice to which Levi assigns the Yod, here it is. We have the triad of Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. Interestingly, the Mensa Isiaca always places the figure representing the fixed cross sign in the center of the triad. According to Kircher, Mendes was the ancient Egyptian name for winter. This triangle represents the three aspects: pater, which means paternal force or generative principle; mens, or mind, which refers to the cosmic organizing intelligence that underpins the natural world; and potentia, or inherent potency, the dynamic creative force that brings ideas into reality. Potentia symbolizes the active and energetic aspect of the triad, representing the ability to manifest and actualize. These three aspects can be personified in all four of the triads. Here's Kircher's description of the winter triad. Could we get a reader for this? I will, as you come to the letters, give me time to actually point them out on the chart so that we can follow along. Could we get a reader, please?
Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. In the first triad, S, the pater, V, the mens or mother, and P, the potentia, from the triad of Mendes, the goat, which is seen on the altar M. This symbol refers to the fecundity of the earth, ready to nourish the germs of growth. It was customary to sacrifice goats at this season as an appeal for a favorable season. Capricornus, translated into the skies, according to the Greeks, refers to Mendes. P is male, and V a female with tumid breast. Each carries a crux ansata, token of the apotropium numen, or intercessory deity. These are symbolic of the active and passive powers of nature, Q and T, are tablets acting as amulets.
Thank you, Barbara. Okay. Right. Okay, any thoughts or questions about this? You can see that even though it seems like we're diving deep into this, we're really just scratching the surface in terms of the philosophical meaning of these figures and their interrelationships. So, and that's, I guess, all we'll do. Unless you have questions, you know, we can try to go deeper into these. Without some background, greater background, it's a bit difficult, you know, to even formulate questions about it. If you read the book that I gave the link to, that would bring up a lot of understanding. That would bring forth quite a bit of understanding. So next comes the second triad, shown here, which relates to spring or Amon in ancient Egyptian, and whose signs are Aries, Taurus, and Gemini. Again, we have the fixed cross sign in the center of the grouping. So again, when you come to each letter, please pause for me to identify the figures. Could we get a reader, please?
Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. In the second triad of Amun, X is the pater, Z, the matter or mens, and A, the potentia. Note the ram almond seen above standing by a plant with three fructifying branches, symbol of the intense and ripening heat of the season. Rabbi Jehuda and the Zohar says, to denote heat, they drew a ram. The horns diverging upwards being types of flames of fire. X is Amon as a warrior with a lance. A Nilit Phenacoporus in his left hand. Z is Mother Isis. Corn and fruit are dedicated. A, the potentia, carries an ibis feather in the right hand and a vase of Nile water in the left. Vignoria says that the peculiar conical skirt of A is to insinuate Piapism. Why? The synostephanus marks the vernal equinox. Below his seat are six circles with crosses of four lines, referring to 24. Because at the equinox, when the day is 12 hours long, this animal was said to urinate every hour through the day and through the night 24 times.
Thank you. So you could see, if we had access to the deeper teachings, we could easily do a webinar just on one of these, right? Just to deeply explore. By the way, priapism has to do with sexual arousal. That's why this, supposedly this skirt denotes that, meaning, you know, the fecund orientation of this figure. Okay. So next we have the third triad, which relates to summer, called in ancient Egypt Momphta, and whose signs are Cancer, Leo, and Virgo. So could we get a reader for this commentary, please?
Ben, can you read that for us, please?
The third triad, named Momphta, refers to summer. Its figures are B, C, and E. It is so called because Momphta is the presiding genius of Leo, the rising Nile, which D, the Nilotic Sphinx, expresses. On the head of D are the crescent moon and the sun. On the base of the Sphinx are six quadrified circles, or 24 days of increase and 24 days of decrease. C is the Pater, an intercessory deity. His vase-shaped headdress is ornamented with circles. A snake emerges from it, and above it are two hawk's feathers and a circle, symbols of the vigor of the sun, heat, and life. His companions are the mens, and Isis, E, and the potentia, B. E wears a white headdress, a vase above it, then horns, stars, and feathers. In her right hand, a feathered scepter, two triangular sistra hanging from it. The horns are Isiak, and the star is Sothis. whose heliacal rising preceded the inundation. The scepter is a weapon against Typhon, who is disturbed by music or noise. B carries an absinthe branch and has a thermuthis on her head. The absinthe, enemy of putrefaction, was plentiful at the beginning of the month Thoth. The Issaic tablet of Cardinal Bembo.
Thank you.
Bembo.
Yeah, it was a cardinal from the 15th century who bought this tablet. And by buying it, it kind of came into a historical existence. He bought it from a blacksmith, evidently. And it had been unearthed from the ruins, from some Roman ruins that had been unearthed. And then it came into possession of this cardinal who paid a really lot of money for it. And it ended up being, and still is, in the museum where the cardinal lived. I can't remember where it was now. You can Google it. If you want to take a flight and go see it, you can, yeah, I'm sure you could locate it. They even tell which gallery it sits in. So it is around. Okay. Lastly, we have the fourth triad, which relates to Autumn or Ulfta, and whose signs are Libra, Scorpio, and Sagittarius. Could we get a reader for this grouping, please?
Selena, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The fourth triad is called Umpha and concerns the autumn. Umpha is the protector of the sun, of the sign Libra, and a beneficent deity ruling when the land of Egypt, pregnant with moisture after the inundation, is so disposed to fecundity. It is the figure G with the thyrus in the right and the phallus occipitalis in the left hand. The combination F holds a cuckoo-headed wand and in the left hand a cup of black earth. Aluvinum, a happy angry of architecture, which is referred to by the beast's tail.
Agriculture.
Agriculture. Thank you. I'm going to blow it up a little bit so I can see a little better. Which is referred to the beast's tail of F and G and G. H is an atoning deity carrying a lotus flower wand to ward off attacks of
Typhon,
the evil one. She also has a full breast symbol of fruitfulness. The Isaiah tablet of
Carbon. They're all from these ECI. We don't have to read that again. Okay, any thoughts or questions? I know this is a bit of a steep learning curve on these. The main point of introducing these is just to show how much is available through the study of these interrelations, right? And for the most part, they aren't taken from the lore or the myth of the Egyptian teachings on associated gods. Many times you can't even really determine which god is being depicted. So it's really a complete system in and of itself. Okay. All right, so next we get back to the text. He says, note the cherubic parallel, man, bull, lion, and eagle. The fourth form is found either as scorpion or eagle, talking about Scorpio, depending upon the occult good or evil intention. And the demotic zodiac, the snake replaces the scorpion. The demotic zodiac was used in Egypt during the Greco-Roman period. So in the Bible, cherubim are described as powerful winged beings who serve as guardians of the divine presence and whose four faces are the symbols of the fixed cross, as described in the text. You'll also see these on the 21st arcana of the Tarot. With up in the four corners, you'll find these four cherubim. The quote unquote cherubic parallel comes through the Mensa Isiaca's fixed cross oriented illustration of the zodiac, meaning that the central figure of each of these three represents the fixed cross, right? Represents the signs of the fixed cross, I should say. Where in the central figure, yeah, and that's indicated by Levi's chart with that upper point of the triangle. And here you have the representative cherubic figures. Next. Oh, here we go. Yeah. So it's these cherubic figures represent this middle point in each of the triangles. Okay, next, the lower region is described as the 12 simple Hebrew letters, associating them with the four quarters of the horizon. Compare the Sefer Yetzirah. Here's the lower register, whose 12 gods and goddesses are associated with the 12 Hebrew simple letters. Levi also divided the lower region into four triads in accordance with the four quarters of the horizon. East is connected with new beginnings, enlightenment, the rising sun, symbolizing birth, renewal, and the awakening of consciousness. North is associated with stability, endurance, and wisdom, and represents the domain of the ancestors and the source of spiritual strength. South is linked to warmth, growth, and vitality. Also symbolizes physical world and the energy of life. And West is associated with endings, transitions, and the setting sun. And it represents the passage into the afterlife and the mysteries of the unknown. So these are universal meanings. I should say generally, they can be corroborated in other teachings about the four directions. You'll see a corroboration in this. I see a hand.
Yes. Magda, please go ahead.
Yes, in the third square, the south thought, which is the fall, the three fall months, which in Christianity is Archangel Michael. But my question is, why it is the first Orient, then North, then Midi, and then Occidente, which is West. Why Midi, which is middle, and not South, representing this quaternary, this triad in the quaternary of the fall season?
The three together represent the south, you could say, are three aspects of the south.
But why in Latin, or I don't know what it is, Midi, Orient, Occidente, why is Midi, which is middle, Midi, mezzo, Midi, and not south, sud, nord, because nord is sud in Latin.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's a good question. I hadn't even looked at that. So we have the Orient, which is, you know, generally represents the East. We all recognize Nord for North and Occident for the West. It's a good question. About the South, I can't answer your question. I don't know where it's actually Eliphas Levi who would have made this assignation that why he would come up with Midi, as you say, which means the middle of. Why he would choose that to represent the South. That's a good good eye that you pointed that out. I can't, but unfortunately, I can't tell you why. It might be, let's see, what country was Eliphaz Levi? Where did he hail from? I'm just wondering if locally that there is an association between Midi and South in his place of origin. Just don't know. Sorry, Magda. Okay, so these are make an incredible read, but we'll just, you know, I had to like hold my hand. I wanted to do all four, but we'll just do one of these lower triads because as you can see, they're quite lengthy and they're, so I didn't want to get too deep. It's always a question, you know, how deep to go with this. So, yeah, so we'll do the East Gate, called the Great East Gate of the World. Could we get a reader, please?
Michelle, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The triad of the Great East Gate of the World, excuse me, presents M, the boy Horus, enclosed in the portico. He is involved in a network, holds a wand with a cuckoo head and a cross upon it, and also a square and a trumpet. Behind his neck hangs a triangle with a globe emerging from it. The portico is ornamented with a winged globe above and its sides with quadrified circles and five pointed stars alternately placed. This gate admits all light, life, and motion, symbolized by the winged globe, to the four parts of the world and the five orders of being. Horus is the sun, which confers heat and light to our earth and rises in the east. The network points out that its origin and powers are hidden from our knowledge. The cross denotes its power over the four elements. The cuckoo head denotes variety of production. The square denotes order and symmetry, and the clarion, harmony. Plato calls the triangle the symbol of the world. The hieroglyphics on the pedestal read thus: the parent of vegetable nature, preserver of moisture, the sacred guardian of the Nile, Osiris, pantomorphous or many-formed genius of living beings and things, making them fertile. N is a female figure, filleted, with a hawk on her head, offering five cups to Horus. This is the matter of men's of the triad. The hawk expresses heat and light, and the five cups are the semina of water, air, minerals, vegetables, and animals. She is a form of Isis. I is the potentia, a female figure with a lotus flower wand, an apse with a turgid breast above it, and a star in her left hand is a cup. Her breast is full. This apse is Ophinian, called Thermothis. This and means the life and motion of things.
Can you go back like a full sentence? You dropped out for a minute.
She is a form of Isis.
Sure, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. I is the potentia, a female figure with a lotus flower wand, an asp with a turgid breast above it, and a star. In her left hand is a cup. Her breast is full. This asp is Ophonian, called Thermothis, and means the life and motion of things.
Thanks. Thank you. Yeah, so, you know, this Ophionian just means having to do with the power of the serpent, right? Which this particular one is called Thermothis. and means the life and motion of things. This is often an assignation to the serpent or the Ophiite grouping. If you remember, there were three Ophites surrounding the IYNX in the center, which represents these three forms of life and motion. Okay, so you can see it.
Francis, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Ben says it's Ta under the canopy paired with his consort Sekhmet under the canopy on the right of that row, creation and destruction.
I don't understand. You said that this is Toth under the canopy?
Ta, Ptah.
Oh, Ta. No, actually yes, I see why you say that because of his he's enclosed in this wrapping, almost like a mummy wrapping, and Ta is often figured in that way, the meaning of which is he's literally because he has incarnated in form, he's like a mummy. He's bound by the form aspect. So this is usually represents a high spiritual being, Ta being a the head of one of the Egyptian hierarchies. I can't remember which city, Heliopolis or Memphis.
Memphis.
Was it Memphis? Thank you. Right. Okay. But here we're told that, but you can't always draw, in fact, you can rarely draw a direct connection between the figures in the Mensa Isiaca that we're exploring here and the original gods, even though they can look similar. What he tells us here is that this is representative of the boy Horus enclosed in the portico.
Although the pairing in that row on the other side is Sekhmet, who would be matched with Ptah, her consort.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so you mean if we
If you look at the whole row, there's another canopy
go
on
back?
the right with Sekhmet.
All right, so
There she is.
oh,
Oh.
oh, that's
Oh,
very
so she would go with Ptah, not Horus.
okay. Oh, that's you have to remember
Fact check.
this is just Westcott's
Yeah.
interpretation. He wrote at the beginning of that previous century. Whereas this Mensa Isiaca, in other words, Mensa Isiaca didn't come with cliff notes, right? It exists in and of itself. This is Westcott's interpretation. I would put real credence to your pairing there. That's very good. Yeah, could you say any more about that? You seem to have some awareness of this. What is the meaning of this pairing? See, what are we looking at here? We're looking at the east and the west, the central figure of both the east and the west, central figure, and the fact that they're in these porticos suggests existence on a higher realm, who then you could say is externalized by the two figures on either side. But beyond that, I can't really speak to it.
Well,
Okay.
Ptah was architect, creator,
Right.
and Sekhmet is destroyer often. War and peace.
Yeah, there's a yeah, so there's a kind of alpha omega here, isn't there? And that fits with the east and west. West is associated with destruction, with the end of a cycle, which is really what destruction is. Yeah, I like that. And then Ta would be the not just creator. I mean, he was a creator god. He was a potter, right? In analogy, but he actually formed humanity on his potter's wheel, so that would definitely connect him with the other part of the first aspect, and So you have the creator aspect of the first, and you have the destroyer aspect of the first here. For instance, the Manu has this same creator aspect, you know, that the he designs and forms the appropriate physiognomy for that, for a particular root race, you know, and their office of the Manu lasts for the length of that root race. And there could be a connection between Ta in that sense, and the Manu. Interesting. Also, Sekhmet here is shown as a goddess. You can see her breast, seemingly a female figure. It's actually a god in actual Egyptian, but has a female counterpart also at the lion's head, whose name I forget, Tefermet or something like that. Anyone else? Did I see a hand go up?
Yes, Ariane, go ahead, please.
I'm having trouble following this in part because there's a lot going on in my personal life. At any rate, I just wanted to ask a few questions first, or make a comment also. Just one question. So this is like the Kabbalah and the Egyptian iconography is being melded together in some way. What was the relationship between like these ancient Egyptians and ancient Hebrew, spiritual cults or whatever? I'm wondering what the relationship is between them, and then I have a comment.
Okay, well, first of all, this, we start with the artifact. You know, this, let me just get out here and go to a picture of the whole thing. We're on page number 63, so we'll go back and find the whole artifact. Where are you? There we go, all the way back to 11. So this is what it looks like. You know, actually, this is a photograph of it, right? Unfortunately, it's not very high resolution. I couldn't find a high resolution. This is the chart that Levi created of this Mensa Isiaka. It's quite beautiful. It's a fold-out chart in the large edition of the Secret Teachings of All Ages. This is, I think, from all the charts I looked at, this is the most readable. So this is what it looks like. This is what they found, you know. And it's made up of various metals, and the metals even, it suggests that they had their philosophical meaning as well, the metals that were used. So that's what we'll start with. It's what we almost certainly know is that it wasn't of Egyptian origin. These figures are Egyptian-like, but for instance, many of the headdresses have nothing to do with anything you would find in Egyptian iconography. And even those are, there's a few like this Ibmorphus figure, which can be related to Thoth. Many of them seem to be combinations of Egyptian gods and goddesses. So, you know, going on that, there are archaeologists that just say, well, the whole thing's just a fake, it's forgery. You know, it's not, but they're relating that to the truth as discovered through the Egyptian iconography. So if you relate it to that, it doesn't directly relate, because remember the nature of hieroglyphs, for instance, was lost even as early as the first century AD. Certainly in Roman culture, they did not know the key that would unlock the hieroglyphs. So modern archaeologists pretty much just dismiss this, as any kind of meaningful artifact. They call it decorative, but that's because they're basing it on The idea that it should have the same Egyptian meanings as other engravings and artifacts found that were directly related to the gods and goddesses of Egypt. But there were those specifically Kircher, and followed by Levi, who discovered this tremendous internal logic. Now I'm getting to the answer of your question, which is this, that there's a universality to that logic that relates it to such disciplines as the Kabbalah and the Tarot, though there is no hard and fast link. There's nothing written about this, at the time. All of this is an attempt to decipher what this table means. But by the time we get to Westcott, who was also a scholar in his own right, in combination with Levi, we come to a point where we actually do have a coherent interrelatedness, and that's what we've been talking about in these descriptions of these various triads and figures.
So this is a product of an esoteric school, is that what you're saying?
Maybe there many believe that it's first of all, it's singular. There is no other
I see.
artifact that is directly related to this Isiac tablet. It's absolutely singular, right? But it's so well developed in terms of its internal logic that it's believed that some great master, possibly, or a school used it, created it, and used it in their own teachings. But nothing else related to it has survived. Maybe someday they'll unearth something, but at this point, not. So we're couching our exploration on the internal logic of this Isiac tablet.
Okay, and then I have one more quick question, perhaps, and then two comments, very short. So when they look at hieroglyphics or even this, how do they decipher the meaning with any accuracy? Like, where does that, for like someone looking at a hieroglyph,
Right. Well,
or
Champollion discovered this extraordinary stone called the Rosetta Stone that had three types of script. There was the Egyptian hieroglyphs, the Greek, and one other form, hieratic writings, I think. And because they knew how to speak the Greek and the hieratic, they quickly realized that these three things said the same thing, even though it was, I don't know, it was like it was a very exoteric listing of
Right. It was the beginning.
it wasn't an important teaching, but it gave them the key and that allowed
Right.
them to crack the hieroglyphic code. That was in the 1800s.
I see. That's wonderful. So I just want to remark on a couple of the metaphors that someone was making when you talk about the clay. So it seems like the Hebrew Bible, in Genesis, where God creates man out of clay, and then also the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, where there's a sense that there's a potter and there's a potter's wheel, and one's life, individual life, is like just made out of clay. And then when we look at Advaita Vedanta, they're always talking about the fact that we're confused by all the names and forms, but we look at the jewelry, but we don't see the gold. So basically, everything is gold, but we just look at the forms and the names. So it just feels like these themes, maybe because people were agricultural, in agricultural societies, they were close to the soil. I don't know, but what do
Right.
you make of that? Maybe that's just an associative comment, not very deep, but it was making me think of that.
No, it's a good comment. And I think there's a lot of cultures that relate the form aspect to clay, you know, and the Bible, I know that associates is made, the Hindus do it, the Egyptians definitely did it. Ta was a potter, you know, he was a creator god who was a potter and formed human beings out of clay. Of course, it's an analogy. So, yeah, good comments. Thank you, Ariane. And good questions. I think probably many benefited from that kind of review of what we're looking at here, because it's complex, puzzling, and also fascinating that this artifact exists. Okay, let's see where the heck we are here.
Lots more comments here. Okay.
Oh, okay, go. Yeah.
Selena says, don't you need opposites to stand on the ends for balance?
Yes. I'm not sure. Let's see, let me go up here. Each one of these triads represents a kind of opposition. Let me again go back. There are triads that clearly describe opposites. For instance, again, if we go up here to number 11, you know that in the central panel, which I'm going to bring up now, you have these pairs of opposites described, you know, in the yeah, this is the complete one. So you have a pair of opposites here showing the watery aspect, and one here showing the opposition and the fiery aspect. That's just one example of the opposites that exist in this Mensa Isiaca. We see also here up in the upper left and upper right hand corners of the central panel. I have them blacked out, but this is the black bull and the white bull, Apis, and they're facing each other. This is its own pair of opposites that represent, you know, just one of the many pairs of oppositions that form a unity through this central figure. So even the triads themselves, I mean, this chart right here really describes it. This triad is in opposition to this triad, together forming the watery aspect. This triad is together with this triad, together forming the fiery aspect. They're all four triads are unified by the central IYNX, the universal Icean figure, which is itself septenary. Okay, so that's sort of the numerical side of the philosophy of this. Of course, to really understand the nature of those triads, you have to do a much deeper dive. But you can see the outer organization pretty easily. In fact, it's illustrated right here, right? At least for the central panel. You know, and then in addition, you have the above group directly related to the group below. There are 12 figures in each, and the below is a kind of externalization of the energies of the above group. So you have another series of opposites, you know, illustrated in those two panels. Okay. All right, let's get back to this.
And then
Yeah.
Magda says, materialistic science or profanes can't know nothing about the cosmic law of seven. And here we see a precise number sequence of 4 times 3 figures. Egyptians and Hebrews belong to the same subrace, but also going back further to the Persians or Hindus, laws and numbers are the same.
Well said. Yeah, outer science can't possibly know of the septenary because they associate only with the seventh, counting from above downwards, you know, that seventh principle, which is the visible outer. And they try to determine the source by means of physical description. So they're just lost in the that which is measurable through the scientific method, you know. Okay, I'm totally lost, but I'll see if I can find us here. We'll explore one of these. We read this. Okay, so we'll go into the next passage, get back into play mode here. I appreciate the conversation and the questions. It's been real interesting. Thank you. So the next passage of the text refers to the middle register. Let's see. Here, yeah. Okay, here we are. So this passage in the text refers to the middle register of Levi's illustration, which symbolizes, of course, the middle panel. I mean, you know, Levi's three-tiered symbol is just a symbolic version of the Mensa Isiaca, right? You can directly apply it. So as we're about to discover. So I've put this text under the illustration so you can refer to it as I read. Okay, so it's this text that I'm talking about, right? So the central region he ascribes to the solar powers and the planetary. In the middle, we see above the sun marked OPS, Alps, and below it is a Solomon seal above a cross, a double triangle hexapla, one light and one dark triangle superimposed, the whole forming a sort of complex symbol of Venus. Okay, so all of this is a description of this central section. So hexapla or hexapla means sixfold. The light and dark superimposed triangles represent the balance of spirit and matter. The central figure's resemblance to the symbol of Venus is pretty clear. By its position, we can assume that the symbol is descriptive of the central figure, meaning, you know, Isis slash Venus. And indeed, there are many associations between Isis and Venus, who here seems to represent the heart of the sun. Okay, yeah, here we go. Next, we have to the Eumemorphos, he gives the three dark planets, Venus, Mercury, and Mars, placed around a dark triangle, erect, denoting fire. So here's the Eumemorphos triad that we've been looking at. This is the heat generating, the fiery, one of the two fiery triads, identified by Kircher as Hermanubis, you know, which is a combination of Hermes and Anubis, represents the planet Mercury. Quote, Q is Eumemorphos, a male divinity with the head of the bird Isis. This is Hermanubis, the Mercury of the Romans, Hermes of the Greeks. The ibis head denotes deity of moisture. The tessellated chair points out the ever-changing state of nature, day and night, heat and cold, etc. Orpheus wrote, who holds the reins of the world splendid on his variegated throne? The figure on the left, who represents the planet Venus, is the feminine mens of the triad, about which Kircher says, O is a female with a full breast. She has long wings reaching to the ground. Her feather wand denotes dominion over airy powers, and the vase on the pedestal, the nourishment of the Nile water. You could also, on a higher tone, the spiral, consider that the waters of life. The hieroglyphics above read, the airy good genius of all nature communicates its power by moisture, so fecundating it. The figure on the right, who represents the planet Mars, is, quote, the executor of the commands of this triad. He is almost naked and his legs apart as in motion. On his pedestal, we read, he penetrates with celerity through the celestial sphere, through the moist kingdom of Mophta, that's Leo, and the sacred Ibimorphous lakes. So, you know, we're just getting a taste. You know, we're like reading the menu, you know, to, for instance, to just penetrate the meaning of what we just read would take a much deeper dive into this material. You know, where do you stop? You tell me, hey, I could spend 20 webinars on this and be happy as a clam, but you know, there's always also this thing of forward motion through the book, right? Okay, as before, we'll read this last paragraph in context with the appropriate graphics. It states, to the Nepthian triad, he gives three light planets, Saturn, Luna, and Jupiter, around a light inverted triangle, which denotes water. There is a necessary connection between water, female power, passive principle, Bina, and the Sephirotic mother, that just means Sephiroth or Kabbalic, and mother and bride. Yeah, this is taken from Mather's book on the Kabbalah. So the connection is that the Nepthian triad, water, the feminine passive principle, and Bina, the Sephirotic mother, all represent receptivity of the solar impression, also symbolized by the gestating Virgoan mother. Okay, before we turn the page, let's take a look at the caption under the illustration that we've been working with. And this is, interestingly, this is a totally different kind of description of this. In fact, it's not really a description of this Levi chart. It's something else altogether, but it is interesting in and of itself. So can we get a reader, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The Isaac tablet, writes Levi, is the key to the ancient Book of Thoth, which has survived to some extent the lapse of centuries and is pictured to us in the still comparatively ancient set of Taraki cards. To him, the Book of Thoth was a resume of the esoteric learning of the Egyptians after the decadence of their civilization. This lore became crystallized in a hieroglyphic form as the Tarot. This Tarot, having become partially or entirely forgotten or misunderstood, its pictured symbols fell into the hands of the sham diviners and of the providers of the public amusement by games of cards. The modern tarot or tarocchi pack of cards consists of 78 cards, of which 22 form a special group of trumps of pictorial design. The remaining 56 are composed of four suits of 10 numerals and four court cards, king, queen, knight, and knave or valet. The suits are swords, militaries, cups, sacerdocy, clocks or wands, agriculture, and shekels or coins, commerce, answering respectively to our spades, hearts, clubs, and diamonds. Our purpose is with the 22 trumps. These form the special characteristic of the pack and are the lineal descendants of the hieroglyphics of the tarot. These 22 respond to the letters of the Hebrew and other sacred alphabets, which fall naturally into three classes of a trio of mothers, a heptad of doubles, and a duodecad of simple letters. They are also considered as a triad of heptads and one part, a system of initiation and on uninitiate. See Westcott's The Isaiah Table.
Okay, so this is, you know, a great text, but it has almost nothing to do with this chart, except in the fact that this central grouping is the symbolism for the 21 aspects that Levi considers to represent the 21 major arcana of the Tarot, right? And then with the central IYNX or the universal deity being akin to the Fool card. So that's really the only connection between this chart and what is written here below. Nonetheless, it's worth exploring. First, the Isiach tablet, writes Levi, is a key to the ancient Book of Thoth, which has survived to some extent the lapse of centuries and is pictured to us in the still comparatively ancient set of Tarot cards. Okay, first of all, there is no single surviving Book of Thoth. The Egyptians stored many texts on a wide range of subjects in what they called the House of Life, which were the libraries of their temple complexes. As Thoth was the god of knowledge, many of these texts were claimed to be his work. That said, the Book of Thoth as a single book was referenced in ancient Egyptian inscriptions. For example, the following is written in chapter 68 of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. You, Imami, are sitting under the branches of a fig tree near Hathor in front of a wide sun disk when she goes to Heliopolis with the writing of the word of God in the Book of Thoth. The association between the Tarot and the Book of Thoth originated with an occult revival in the 19th and earliest 20th centuries, where scholars and mystics sought to connect the Tarot with ancient wisdom and esoteric knowledge. The first to do so was the French occultist Antoine Cour de Gobelin in the late 18th century. In his 1781 work, Le Monde Primitif, he puts forward the idea that the Tarot had, or Tarot, had ancient Egyptian origins and linked it to the Book of Thoth, but he gave no empirical evidence to support either of these assertions. Nevertheless, there are convincing arguments that suggest a connection. For example, the fact that the structure of the Tarot deck with its 22 major arcana and 56 minor arcana cards reflect the ancient Egyptian calendar and its division of the year into 22 seasons and 56 weeks. Cour de Gobelin also identified certain symbolic parallels, linking, for instance, the high priestess to the Egyptian god Isis and the magician with Thoth, the god of wisdom and magic. But it really wasn't until Eliphas Levi, in his reflections on Kircher's Oedipus Aegyptiacus, that a link was made between the Mensa Isiaca and the Tarot. Okay, next. Any questions? All right. To him, the Book of Thoth, we're talking about Levi, was a resume of the esoteric learning of the Egyptians. After the decadence of their civilization, this lore became crystallized in a hieroglyphic form as the Tarot. Again, no concrete evidence that the Book of Thoth was a, quote, resume of the esoteric knowledge, but references to the book do appear in various ancient texts, including the pyramid texts and the coffin text. And these references indicate that the text was highly revered and utilized by priests and scholars in ancient Egypt. But the next part, that the Book of Thoth became, quote unquote, crystallized in a hieroglyphic form as the Tarot, that's pure conjecture. You know, by seeing some symbolic connections, they make this sweeping statement, which has no foundation in any archaeological evidence or empirical evidence whatsoever. Next. Now, it's possible that, you know, the Tarot had its origins in ancient Egypt, certainly not by that name, but then it was rediscovered, you know, but there's absolutely no evidence to this. Okay, next. This Tarot, having become partially or entirely forgotten or misunderstood, its pictured symbols fell into the hands of sham diviners and of the providers of the public amusement by games of cards. There is no record or even any mention of the Tarot before 1440. It was introduced not as a philosophical tool, as he suggests here, but as a deck of playing cards. It really wasn't until 340 years later that Antoine Coeur de Gobelin suggested that the Tarot had philosophical implications. Next, the modern, how are we doing? Well, we still have a couple minutes. Next, the modern Tarot or Taroki pack of cards consists of 78 cards, which 22 form a special group of trumps or pictorial design. The remaining 56 are composed of four suits of 10 numerals and four court cards, king, queen, knight, and knave or valet. I think most of you know this already. The suits are swords, militarism, cups, sacerdoci, which is mean having to do with religion, clubs or wands, agriculture, and shekels or coins, commerce, answering respectively to our spades, hearts, clubs, and diamonds. So here's the BOTA, an acronym for Builders of the Adytum Major Arcana, which I consider to be the most esoteric of the available decks. There's some amazing esotericism in Crowley's deck, but I don't recommend following Crowley's teachings, so I don't include his deck here. And here's the Rider-Waite Minor Arcana, because the BOTA Minor Arcana are just numbers, basically. You know, for instance, it'll show five wands in formation, whereas here they're actually pictured, giving us a little more idea of what these cards might mean. Finally, our purpose is with the 22 trumps. These form the special characteristic of the pack and are the lineal descendants of the hieroglyphs, glyphics of the Tarot. Okay, these 22 respond to the letters of the Hebrew and other sacred alphabets, which fall naturally into three classes of a trio of mothers, a heptad of doubles, and a duodecad of simple letters, just meaning 3, 7, and 12. They are also considered as a triad of heptads and one apart. So 3 sevens plus one apart, meaning the fool, a system of initiation and an uninitiate. I'm not sure what he means by that, except for he references Westcott's Issiac tablet. So maybe Westcott elaborates on that last phrase. So here's the major arcana correspondence to the letters of Hebrew alphabet. We're not going to go through these, but just so that you realize that each of the 21 have an associated letter. And the Tarot by Paul Foster Case, as well as a number of other authors, use these letters in their interpretations to get a sense of how, but we're not going to have time today, to get a sense of how significant the connection between the Hebrew letters and the Tarot Major Arcana can be. We'll take a look next time at an excerpt from Case's The Tarot on how the Hebrew letter Aleph relates to the Fool's Arcanum. So you might say, what in the world does this have to do with the Mensa Issiaca? Well, the point he's making here is that the 21 trumps of the Tarot relate to this central group of 20, let me get there. Yeah, here it is. Of these 21, you could say, points that are represented by the four triads. This actually should be extended. Should actually go out to here on either side. And no one that I know has attempted to actually say, you know, for instance, the magician, you know, is this figure which represents Hermes, you know, and going straight through and try to relate each to them. I don't think even Westcott tries to do that, but that they're, the idea is that these, the 21 represented here and the 21 Tarot are related. It would take a deep study, but he does make a definite association between the Fool and this central IYNX figure, which is interesting in and of itself. And that is all we'll be doing today. So next time we'll pick up with this quote to illustrate how the Tarot relate to the letters. And it's convincing, this relationship. You know, the 21 letters to the 21 arcana. Okay, sorry to take you a few minutes over. Do you have any?
Yeah, we have one more comment from Ben. He says the early record of Tarot mentioned as 1440 followed the Primo Conclave of 1425.
Oh yeah, that's a nice association. Primo Conclave being the first hierarchical conclave, which brought forth the third ray into active use, or it was at that time, and that's just following that was the introduction of the Tarot. So there's, you know, possible association there. Good thought, Ben. Anyone else?
Janet says 22 cards are the paths of the Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm. And there's been reference made to that. You can find illustrations if you Google the Tree of Life. You can find illustrations that show those paths related to the Tarot, as opposed, for instance, to the Sephiroth, the 10 Sephiroth themselves, right? You have the paths are related. So they're thus suggesting that these arcana are action or activities, relational, I should say, really, it's a better way of saying it. Except for the Fool who stands at the center and yet personifies all the movement throughout the Tree of Life. Anyone else? Well, thank you for participating. You know, this is not a walk in the park, as they say. And we're just touching on that much deeper study here. But I did want to at least give some examples of how profound this Mensa Issiaca is. Okay.
All right, dates.
Yeah.
The next treatise in cosmic fire is the 13th of June. The next secret doctrine will be the 15th of June. And the next secret teaching of all ages will be the 6th of July. So we're back on schedule. The treatise on cosmic fire is the second and fourth Friday of every month at 7 p.m. GMT, right now during summertime. And the secret doctrine is always the third Sunday, unless we have to uproot the schedule. And Stoa is always the first Sunday, all at 7 p.m. GMT during summertime. So,
okay, and I want to add one other comment, which is that these webinars are now hanging by a thread in terms of participation. I can't spend the time. These take an average of 30 to 40 hours to create a webinar in order to present to a half a dozen people. So if you want to see them continue, show up. You know, we're today, for instance, we're at the absolute minimum of 10 guests in order to host one of these webinars. So we had to cancel the last TCF because I think there were six that showed up. There was also a problem with the announcement. It came just 10 minutes before the webinar started. So I think that had something to do with it. But, you know, the people I really need to be talking to aren't here. But those of you who are here, if you want to see these series continue, continue to participate. So thank you.
Thank you, everybody, and hope to see you next time.
Okay, bye for now.